Welcome to Chatter on Books. I'm your announcer, Jamie McIntyre. We attempted to come up with a creative introduction to the show, but our writers are on strike. Here's Tori Clark.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. It is Chatter on Books. It is election eve, and I was writing some notes this morning. I think the watchword for this evening and probably for the next couple of days is context. But in a little bit, we'll be talking to David S. Reynolds, who is this incredible person who is an historian. He's a teacher. He's an editor. He has had written several books, clearly never sleeps because he's now produced this tome. If you looked up the word tome in dictionary, his book, Abraham Lincoln and His Time, would be under that word because it's huge and it's amazing. And we're very happy, of course, to have Claude doing all the important work, to have David Aldridge back. I've never had two Davids on the show. I'm going to have to be careful. And a Chatter on Books alum, Mike Crowley, is back with us. Mike from Denison, who was with us last year, I think, one of our favorites on Chatter on Books. And he's going to be talking a little bit with us about Midland, Reports from Flyover Country, which is a really interesting collection of essays. It was pulled together in the wake of the 2016 election. And the lessons and the messages in there are very, very timely. But I've got a couple things I got to rip off here. One, we have a handwritten thank you note, which as regular Chatter on Books listeners know, I just love. Not that anyone can see this, but I'll hold it up for the guys. This is from our friend Erica Wright, who wrote Famous in Cedarville and was with us a couple weeks ago with her book about snakes. So her lovely her lovely handwritten note, and I just so appreciate handwritten notes, includes a tattoo of a snake. But it says, "Dear Tori, thank you for having me back on the show. Chatter on Books is such an exceptional podcast. Erica's a very smart person. And it was a treat to chat with you, David and Ed. I hope that none of your irrational fears ever turn rational. Best wishes, Erica." So anybody who writes handwritten notes always gets asked about, as we've learned. A couple of news items. And I'm going to, David Reynolds, you're just going to jump in here with us. And you're probably the smartest person here. But we'll just do this. News.
He's not the dumbest, I can tell you that.
No, I'm the dumbest. That's why I get to ask the questions. Has anybody on this podcast heard the phrase, I will mispronounce it, anthropodermic bibliopegy?
No.
David Aldridge.
I'm pretty sure they finished second in the Belmont in 63, if I remember correctly.
Mike Crowley.
No.
Okay, it's pretty horrifying. And there's a book about it now called Dark Archives, A Librarian's Investigation into the Science and History of Books Bound in Human Skin. And this popped up in the news the other day, and I thought, oh, this is just some stupid thing. And I used to spend a lot of time in Germany, and there are always these legends. But no, there are groups, and there are organizations, and there are entities that study this practice, and it's not a one-off kind of thing. It has happened, and it's happened with enough frequency that Megan Rosenblum has written a book about it. It's absolutely horrifying. And there are places like the Houghton, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, the Houghton Library at Harvard, who have one or two of these books. Oh. And you just say to yourself, what are you doing? Right? What are you doing to get rid of those?
How are they sold? Do they say, are they under are they conditioned?
Yes. And there was a really, really elaborate, robust process that these so-called experts now go through to determine whether or not truly is human skin or was it trying to be a replica. And there was a certain cadre of people who wanted their books bound in human skin, and they would treasure book human skin that had tattoos on them because that would add to the value. Absolutely horrific. And thank God my dad, the doctor, is dead, because there were a fair number of doctors in the 1800s who thought this was a kind of a cool thing to do. They would gather and it would build collections of medical tomes, and they liked the ones that were bound in human skin, which is
horrifying. You see the look on my face right now?
Oh, it's horrifying.
I can't unhear that.
Yeah. Okay. We should have done this before Halloween. We should have done it before Halloween. Okay. On a happier note, Oprah. And, I think anybody who writes books, anybody who sells books should thank Oprah, because I think she really, however many years ago it was, really said to rank and file people in this country, in this world, it's cool and it's fun and it's hip and it's wonderful to read books. And then she was one of the first people who truly made it a populist kind of thing. We have our, David Aldridge and I have our friends in DC who are people of the book, who would be horrified about anything that Oprah does. But I know so many people who started reading, or they read books because They trust her. They believe in her, those kinds of things. Oprah has come out with the books that helped me through the pandemic. And Oprah, if you guys don't know, this is always very open and very honest about her feelings. And she says, I have all the blessings in the world. I have all the money in the world. I have everything in life, but the pandemic's getting to me too. So she's turning to books as her comfort food, which she also says is better than turning to comfort food. So I'll read you a couple of hers, and then I'll ask you guys if you have comfort books. The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle, which Oprah says has changed the course of her life and continues to guide her. And if you're an Oprah fan, as I am, you've heard her talk about it many times. The Soul of America by John Meacham, which, David Reynolds, you may know this, but that book by John Meacham comes up again and again and again in so much commentary. Devotions by the late Pulitzer Prize winning poet Mary Oliver. Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon. And a book that's out recently, I don't know anything about it, When the Light of the World Was Subdued, Our Songs Came Through, a Norton Anthology of Native Nations Poetry. But she's very open. She's very honest about this and says she shouldn't be completely distraught and depressed by everything going on with the pandemic, but she is. And she turns to these books. So Mike Crowley, I'll turn to you first. Do you have comfort books you turn to in times of stress? Yeah. Or is it the whiskey that I have in my chat?
Books to the bourbon, but I think when I want to read I had a teacher when I was young, she told me, if you want to be a writer, you can't read any trash. And so I've never actually been able to read like comfort books. So for me, it'll be like a really riveting nonfiction book. I'll try to find like a good nonfiction book. Usually it's not fiction. So I'd think it'd be good. And like a good sports book, honestly, for me.
Yeah. David Aldridge?
Have I mentioned my love for, and now of course I'm blanking on his name, the Carl Hyacin. Have I mentioned my love of Carl Hyacin books?
No, but we're trying to get him
I'm
on the
show. Big Carl Hyacin fan. Now I feel inadequate next to Crowley because he says you shouldn't read trashy novels.
Crowley didn't come up with a title, so far he's
losing. All that Carl Hyacin writes. He was the and may still be a columnist at the Miami Herald.
Yeah.
And specializes in these great, wonderful books about these elaborate, awful people. Always populated in Miami. All of his books are populated in Miami or in Florida or in the Panhandle somewhere. These people who trash the land, these polluters, these murderers, these people who don't care about the human suffering, and they always get their comeuppance at the end. And it's this wonderful series of books about these criminals and the awful fates that, because of their own hubris and their own stupidity. And I think in these times, I can certainly get behind books where people like that get their comeuppance. So
I agree. A lot of tattoos in Carl Hyacin books.
A lot of
interesting relationships. David Reynolds, I can't believe you're such a serious dude. I cannot believe there's comfort reading in your life. Is there comfort reading?
I went to Amherst College with Scott Turow. Didn't you interview Scott recently?
We did. We love Scott Turow.
Yeah, and he was in my English classes. So he provides me comfort with some of his novels, just because I like, he's both a popular novelist, but also I think a good writer.
Really good writer. When we had him on the show, one of the greatest things was we said to him, which is true, he makes the legal profession so accessible and he understands the legal profession so well.
Yeah.
But in his last one, it was about the pharmaceutical industry. And I know just enough about that industry to be dangerous. But I said, you really got it. You understood it. His daughter, right, David Aldridge? His daughter was in the pharmaceutical industry. And he goes, I was so terrified I would get something wrong. I worked harder on that than I've ever worked on anything.
Yeah.
When I thought about this question, reading Oprah stuff, I thought, okay, what's mine? And now that you say Carl Hyacin, David, but I have this habit of waking up at 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the morning, just padding around and trying very hard not to pick up my phone. And there are two books that I pick up all the time. And they're both by Tom Wolfe, Bonfire of the Vanities and The Right Stuff.
No.
No idea why, but it might just be because they're so beautifully written.
Yeah.
And you could read a page.
Yeah, he's a great writer. Yeah.
Yeah. You could just read a page in either one of those books and go, okay.
The chapter on Chuck Yeager is just phenomenal. Yeah. It's just
Yeah,
he starts on the airplane, and we've all heard that West Virginia drawl of the pilot. And oh my God, that's beautiful, evocative right? writing, right? And then fantastic. And
they hold up so well.
Yeah.
Incredibly well. Okay. Yeah. Mike Crowley, let's talk about Midland for a second, sure. More than a second. So I've read this whole thing. It's called Midland.
Yeah.
It's called Reports from Flyover Country. And I know the story of how this collection of essays came to be, but tell us the story of how this came to be. And it's pretty relevant to what's going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah, sure. So there was a lot of consternation at the election in 2016, to put it mildly. And
surprise.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, even though the exit polls said that white working class people went for Hillary, it still became this Trump country, Trump narrative. And sort of where we live here in Ohio, even though it's sort of a college town and not far from Columbus, you know, my wife kept telling me, like, he's going to win. And when I thought about how we traveled the farm country up to Cleveland to see her family, it was nothing but Trump signs. Uh-huh. And I kept telling her, there's no way he's going to win. And then, of course, it came to pass. And then you started just getting all these sort of, I don't know what the way to, like, kind of, I told you so, you can't depend on these people kind of takes on Appalachia, rural America, the Midwest. And there's a writer out in Nebraska named Ted Genoways, who's a very good writer, a very good journalist. And he kind of marshaled all of the journalists that he knew. He started just tagging people in every Midwestern state that he knew, saying, like, look, we still have to do our jobs. We still have to report on this country. We still have to report on this administration. And he was the one that sort of kind of spurred this idea that we would have a journalism conference here at Denison to get these people in the middle of the country together to talk about what the national media had missed. And that's really how the book kind of came about. We had a conference. We had a conference the weekend of the inauguration, or a week after the inauguration, thinking like, we'll do one early and we'll talk about how we need to cover this administration, how we'll cover the issues in this country, thinking like not a lot of stuff would happen. And that's when the travel ban went down. During our keynote speaker, the travel ban came down and suddenly everybody was on their phone, you know, texting their editors and their bureaus and like, what do we do? How do we cover this? So we sort of, and as time went on, we got to know these people. We got to see their stories. We got to read their stories. And it just became, it was like a snowball effect, really, of, there are so many good journalists in the middle of the country that the coastal media is always pushing in and sitting in parachute reporting. And we're pretty honest about that. Like, you need good parachute reporting, but it's not cool when someone from the Post shows up in Kansas and talks to the NPR reporter and says, can you give me your contacts? Can you give me your sources? Instead of like the NPR person being able to report their own story. That happens more than we think it does. So we wanted to create a journalism that pushes out to the coast. And I'll tell you one quick story was that we were supposed to have Connie Schultz give the keynote speech at the last one that we had, and then she couldn't. So at the last minute, we found, I won't say his name, but we found someone who'd been the former political director of CNN during the 2016 election. He came to give the speech. I said, all right, here's the room. All these people are working journalists. They all are working in rural America. We're all pushing against this narrative of Trump country. This is your room. He got up there and he spoke to the room as if we'd all been on Mars in 2016 and we had no idea what had occurred. And he put forth that same narrative. The white working class went for Trump. He captured rural America. You know, he completely ignored the idea that, you know, lots of college educated people voted for Trump. And
okay, you won't use his name, but I could figure it out. And I, of course, will.
And it was really, it was, I mean, by the end of that speech, there were like four people who were too polite to get up, who were still sitting there. And everybody else was at the bar going, can you believe this is happening?
Yeah.
What is going on? So that was really how the book came about. And we wanted to make sure we got some new voices in there. We got some established voices in there. We got people that never published anything before. You know, it was really inclusivity was important to us because that is the middle of the country. And we don't think about that. You know, one of my favorite pieces is by a woman from Indiana, Tamara Winfrey, which is about Black Midwestern voters. Like, she's like, we're a thing. Hey, we're everywhere. Right. You know,
one of the most amazing thing about the collections of the essays is the diversity of their stories, because those who, you know, the big smart people in New York, Washington, LA, San Francisco, et cetera, tend to just, it's a stereotype. Midwest is all white. They're all Rust Belt. I mean, Connie Schultz and I had a great time talking a couple weeks ago, thanks to Mike. I mean, we're sick and tired about the whole Rust Belt thing. And there's a stereotype that they all look like this and they all look the same. And the diversity of the stories in this collection, Mike, I mean, the Black Midwesterner, the LGBTQ, that was a thing that really struck me. It's like, it was almost like, you remember Horton Hears a Who? We are here. We are here. You have to hear us. But they're lovely. Do you have a favorite? Do you have a favorite story in the book? Is that unfair?
Yeah, I have a couple. I like Ted Genoway, who I mentioned. I like him a lot, which is about how these you know, unlikely bedfellows, environmentalists and far right wing isolationists get together to stop a Costco chicken plant from being formed. In I forget the name of the Fremont, Nebraska, where it has always been sort of a kind of an itinerant place. Yeah. I like that a lot, just about the strange bedfellows that sort of crop up and like how they sort of get along. It ultimately disintegrates, but they do sort of try to work together. And it's kind of this version of America that we forget about, that this is always our story, that immigrants come in, the established white people are like, what are you doing here? Then they find a way to work together, and then things will probably break down later. That's a really good one. And Wendy Walters' piece about voters in Detroit, in suburban Detroit, that's a piece that I like a lot too, just for, it's a really reported piece, but it's very personal because she grew up there. Her father worked in the chicken plant. And then the last one, the one that everyone loves, and I love it too, is Brian Mueller's essay about taking his 90 some year old cousin on an odyssey across the U.S. to try to get to the White House so that she can meet her hero, Donald Trump. And along the way, he stops at churches and tries to like have these Christian, his faith is very important. He actually left journalism to go to Union Theological in New York City this past year. I mean, he's still doing journalism, but he feels like he can do the most good as a pastor. That was a really fun one.
I love Bodies on the Line, which is about coal miners who, as the essay says, they were lied to by their bosses. They were lied to by the politicians. Yeah. And they literally had to put their bodies on the line as the trains were moving.
Yeah, that one was, she's a local NPR reporter. She'd never really published anything. And we reached out to her because of my Kentucky ties, you know, and where I grew up. And she was actually kind of a little snippy with us when we reached out to her. She's kind of suspicious of our aims, you know. She's like, whoa. And then, like, we had to explain to her, like, who we are and who I was. But that ended up being a great piece. And she went back and did some extra reporting on that to make sure she got things right. And I think that piece is really indicative of where we are, where you know, these guys are being sort of exploited by the companies, yet they don't go with, so I don't mean that whole thing about people vote against their economic interests, right? Because people on the Upper West Side of Manhattan do that all the time. Yeah. But I think like that idea that they're being exploited by a company and yet they're not doing the next step of work to sort of see like what their political candidates are going to do for them, you know, or which political candidate will actually have their interest in mind. But that was a great piece where like, there's no winners in that, right? Yeah. There's no winners.
Do you think, is there another Midland Reports from Flyover Country after tomorrow? So most people will be listening to the show tomorrow or this week. So after this week's election?
Yeah, I do. I think the next one, if Simon and Schuster will let us, the next one is going to be about income inequality or it's going to be about climate change. And I think that's, you know, not to get too much like on a high horse or anything, but the climate change is a big one. Our farms are in trouble for lots of reasons. But, you know, that's something that we don't realize. I don't think a lot of people realize like how under duress they are. The flooding is a big problem in the Midwest. It's not getting better. And then when you bring in like these chicken plants and these chicken farms, you know, all that raw sewage, it's got to go somewhere. And so this is going to be a big problem as the world gets hotter, that's actually going to really compress the Midwest. And I don't know if you guys have seen those models, but like most people are going to try to get to the middle of the country because it's going to be so hot and underwater everywhere else.
Yeah.
So there's going to be a lot of stress. So yeah, we kind of hope to do something on that if they let us do it.
Cool. If you write me a nice handwritten thank you note again, you can come back and share that one with us. Okay, guys, of the many things I encourage you to buy, it's called Midland. It's Reports from Flyover Country. It's wonderful. You can read one chapter, then put it down, pick it up again. It's great. Okay, David S. Reynolds, let's talk to you about this incredible book. So, David, I've done a lot of reading, a lot of research on you, and you seem like a very smart guy. Historian, teacher, editor, commentator. You've written about Walt Whitman. You've written about John Brown. You know this space And you decide, despite the fact that over 15,000 people evidently have written books about Abraham Lincoln, you decide, I got to write a book about Abe Lincoln. Why? What possessed you?
Well, yeah, you know, it's I've lived my whole scholarly career, which goes back to, I won't say aught eight, but maybe eight aught. You know, it goes back a long way. Anyway, I've sort of lived in his era, so to speak, and I wrote books on all kinds of people: Walt Whitman, Harriet Beecher Stowe, George Lippard, who nobody else has read, but and he was a bestseller back then, and
yeah,
and most of the popular newspapers I've read and everything, and Lincoln was always there as. You know, Walt Whitman compares him to the Western star, the star in the heavens. And in a way, mm-hmm. he was kind of there beaming from above. But I never thought that seriously about him until I wrote my books, my sort of big books on Walt Whitman, Walt Whitman's America, and then on John Brown, because Whitman became totally obsessed by Lincoln. And they never met, but they saw each other on the streets of Washington when Whitman had gone.
Which is just amazing. Yeah. You write about it beautifully in the book, but they literally would pass each other and they would exchange.
Yeah, and they would bow to each other. There's an apocryphal story that Lincoln was looking out of the White House window and said and saw this white bearded guy and said, "Now that's a man. That's a man." And there's another story about how when he was younger, when I don't include either of these in my book because they're probably apocryphal, when he was in his law office and his law partner, Herndon, Lincoln's law partner, Herndon, had the first edition of Leaves of Grass. Wow. And Lincoln opened it and started reading it out loud. And I sing myself and celebrate myself in area. But I mean, you know, there are these kind of stories of direct contact. But in general, Whitman said that he saw him maybe 20 times riding around in his carriage, particularly out to the soldier's home, which was just outside of Washington. And it was like the vacation spot. And they would sometimes sort of bow to each other and that kind of thing. But anyway, and I still wasn't thinking about, and then John Brown, in my book on John Brown, I compare him to Lincoln as well. Although Lincoln sort of shoved aside John Brown, who's something of an embarrassment for Lincoln. Even though they were on the same page on slavery, John Brown, you know, did his weird thing down in Harper's Ferry and everything, which Lincoln considered lawless, you know.
Yeah.
So, but it got me kind of thinking. And then I wrote a book proposal on the Founding Fathers. I said, well, let me get out of this era on the Founding Fathers. And I sent it to my agent, Lynn Nesbitt, who you remind me a little, Victoria, a little bit of Lynn. Have you ever met Lynn?
I've not met Lynn, but I know of her. So now I'm enormously flattered. Lynn.
Yeah. And she talk about bonfires. She was the agent for Tom Wolfe and for all his books. Yeah. She's a very, very good person, very good agent. But anyway, she sent my proposal to all the big publishers and they all loved the proposal, but none of them were kind of biting, you know, bite.
Uh-huh.
Except this one publisher, Penguin, said, "I kind of like this paragraph on Lincoln."
Wow.
Yeah. Can you, one little paragraph on Lincoln. And I,
what did you say about him in the one little paragraph?
Gosh, I don't even remember. I really don't remember because that was back in 2000. I'm really dating myself now.
No, it's pandemic brain.
At least I didn't say 18. Okay. I live in the 19th century.
That's right.
No, this was like back in 2012. And gosh, It was a little bit Meacham-like in the sense, a little bit like Soul of America kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Anyway, so and he liked it, and he bit, and you know, and Lynn everybody loved it. And then I started writing. And in a way, I realized when I began writing this book, I knew of these 16,000, not that I've written, read every one of the 16,000 books, but I have a pretty good sense of, you know, the terrain. And you can read book after book after book about Lincoln and not encounter Walt Whitman or Edgar Allan Poe or even Harry Beecher Stowe or you know, you can read book after book. And I said, this was his era. This was the time he was living with. And it so happens that he memorized Edgar Allan Poe even though he didn't know, I don't think that he knew of Whitman's poetry, particularly early on. Although I will say that Herndon did have Lisa Grass in the law office. So we can.
He might have picked it up. It might have been.
Might have picked it up. But anyway, my point is that the entire culture around him really had been left out. And so I write a cultural biography in which I interweave Lincoln and his contemporary culture, because Emerson, another writer who is rarely mentioned in any book about Lincoln, singled out Lincoln as being the one. His essay on heroes, the one great hero who really spans the entire range of culture, from the very highest. Lincoln could memorize Shakespeare, could recite Shakespeare by the page. And Byron and Burns. Someone said that he had memorized all of Burns. I don't believe that, but a lot of poetry of Burns. At the same time, he loved kind of dirty humor and frontier humor. And Emerson said he ranges even as far as Lowe's. So the very dogs believe in him. The very dog. And in a way, that's true. I mean, he really, and it's that Lincoln that I really try to reproduce. It really has never been put in a book before. And I think, which I thought was really unfortunate, because when Lee surrenders to Grant on April 9th, 1865, and Lincoln happened to be on a boat because he had been visiting Grant in Virginia, was going back to Washington on a boat. And everyone, you know, somehow people heard of what was happening. It was a foregone conclusion anyway. Everyone was celebrating, all the officials. And Lincoln said, you know, I want to discuss this soliloquy in Shakespeare. And he took out his Shakespeare. He had it memorized, but he took out the Shakespeare book and read it. And I also want to discuss this poem by Longfellow. And these were all passages about death. And I came to the realization that he was sitting there. Everyone else was saying, what are we going to do during Reconstruction? And isn't this the greatest thing in the world? And Abe, you must be so happy because we won the victory and everything. He said, you know, his basic heart, his very large heart, was basically thinking about, you know, 750,000 Americans died during the Civil War. He was fundamentally thinking, and these were all passages and poems about death. Some of them had happy endings, you know, you go to heaven and all of that. But still, he was meditating. He was thinking deeply about what had happened. He didn't just say, mission accomplished. Mission accomplished, yay! Or I'm the greatest, you know, I'm Caesar, or, you know, whatever. So, it's that kind of Lincoln that I'm really interested in.
Reading through the book, every single page, I could have come up with six or seven questions. And Mike, I know you dug through some of this, so jump in here. But it really addresses so many of the conventional wisdoms and turns a lot of them upside down. He was this incredibly worldly, well-educated, enlightened guy, clearly an enlightened guy. But that was self-made. It had to have been self-made. He didn't have much of an education. Mary, I mean, everybody loves to trash first ladies. Everybody loves to trash Mary, but you present a different side of her. And so many of these things almost present the conventional wisdom and then say, here's where I think it was wrong, or here's where a different take on that. You are known as one of the best scholars of this era, of Abraham Lincoln, et cetera. Did you get any blowback from, not that there are any peers to David S. Reynolds, but did you get any blowback from any of the so-called peers in this space on any of these theories?
Well, so far, no. I think I will, because I think there are a couple of more books coming out on Mary Lincoln that kind of perpetuate the thing of, you know, sort of corrupt and mentally ill and all of that. And that's kind of what they focus on. And I believe that's coming down the line, and they may very well challenge me, which is fine. I mean, I'm used to having challenges. I had the advantage of having a few really responsible scholars, including a couple of Lincoln scholars who read my manuscript and kind of took me up a little bit on a couple of things. I said, you know what, you're right. So, I mean, I don't want to get into details about certain aspects of the book, right, but certain, you know, and so I was lucky enough that, fortunate enough that they kind of gave me a little blowback, which I really enjoy. Uh-huh. I mean, I enjoy it because I like to be as close to accurate as possible.
Right.
So,
So it took a few years to write this book. You do intense research. Did anything surprise you? Did you learn something about him you didn't know? Or did you go, wow, I didn't see that side of him?
Well, there's the whole issue of Lincoln and race. And I was struck by a few early speeches in Illinois there where he said things, Negroes, as they called them back then, I have never said that they could sit on juries or vote or something like that. And they really kind of turned me off and turned a lot of other people off. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people characterize him really as sort of fundamentally racist. So I was kind of very, very surprised. I went back there and he said those things during his debates with Stephen Douglas, who was an absolute, racist. And he was the first to say America should be controlled by white European people. I mean, he said that, he actually beat Lincoln in that Senate race, although Lincoln won the popular vote, but he won the Senate of Illinois. But anyway, and I had to frame those statements, which today are quite reactionary, within the context of Illinois, which at the time had what Frederick Douglass called the worst black law of any law, north or south, of any law in the entire nation, which was that if a free African-American person who was not already living within Illinois entered the state, he or she had to leave within 10 days or else face a $500 fine, which back then was like an immense amount of money. That was astronomical, or go to jail. So, I mean, and so I really try to frame that whole early, somewhat shocking, racist passage there in that kind of context. And I also was very struck how within five blocks of Lincoln in Springfield, 21 African Americans were living in his neighborhood, and he became quite close to several of them, and defended one of them, his barber, Florville, for free in court,
right,
and helped Florville really quite a lot, and Florville became very, very much attached and beloved. They loved each other. And then when he goes to Washington, he tries to help out someone from Illinois, an African-American who comes with him named Johnson. And he's being actually teased because he is very, very black. He's been being teased by, or whatever you want to call it, by lighter skinned African-Americans. And so Lincoln really tries to get him a more a better job. And just little things like that I try to trace. And eventually he becomes profoundly respected by Frederick Douglass, who earlier on had been quite dubious of him. And Sojourner Truth, who the aged feminist African-American who comes to the White House to visit him. And she is just stunned out by her feeling of closeness to him. And then Martin Delaney, who was really sort of beyond Black Lives Matters. You know, he was almost really into like Malcolm X or something. I mean, he was very, very radical. But he comes and Lincoln wants to give him the highest position in the army for an African-American up to that point. And Delaney is just awestruck by this, and he's going to do it. But then the war ends. And then when Lincoln dies, Delaney weeps like an absolute child for like an hour, and also wants to construct a monument to Lincoln, but not picturing Lincoln, but picturing an African-American woman rising from her knees with tears running down her face into a basin. And this was to be paid for by a penny from each of the enslaved previously enslaved 4 million people who had been liberated by Abraham Lincoln. So I was saying this really kind of goes against what a lot of people are saying. And another thing that surprised me was a lot of people are nowadays, not a lot, but some people are attacking the Lincoln Monument because he did supervise the largest mass hanging in American history, the hanging of 38 Native Americans.
A very tragic, complicated story.
A very, very tragic. Yeah. What had happened, the Sioux Indians in Minnesota had, frankly, understandably, risen up. They had been totally screwed over, totally screwed over by white people. I mean, well, frankly, so were virtually all Native Americans back in the 19th century, from Andrew Jackson onward. And they did commit certain atrocities, but well over 300 of them were slated to be hanged. And Lincoln, he had been a lawyer. He said, no. He himself carefully went through, with somebody's help, through all the documents. And he said,
it took some extraordinary amount of time doing it, right?
A lot. A lot of time. And he was supervising a civil war at the time. But he said, we're not going to hang all 330 of these people. We're going to whittle this down. And he whittled it down. It doesn't sound like much today, but if you go from well over 300 to 38, at least that was something. He tried to look at each case individually. So, yeah.
Anyway. So here's a dumb question based on everything you know about him. You know, if you looked at Abraham Lincoln on paper, he shouldn't be enlightened. He shouldn't care about these people, whether it was the African-Americans or it was the Native Americans. There's, you know, not in his upbringing, not any formal education. So he shouldn't care. What was it? Why do you think he did care? What was it that inspired him to try to help those less fortunate?
Yeah.
Is there a defining moment in his life? Is there...
Right. Well,
the country just blessed that that's the way he was at the time?
Yeah. I think the transition comes, the real transition toward what he later called malice toward none, charity to all. The transition comes when the beginning of a transition begins in 1841. He's born in 1809, but in 1841, he visits his friend Joshua Speed, who lives in Kentucky, who his family holds people in slavery, Speed's family does. And we don't know what Lincoln thought about that, but on the way home, he did see enchained people, Black people that were enchained, and they were going to be sold south. And at the time, he wrote Mary Speed, who was the sister of Joshua Speed, and said, well, they seemed like the happiest people on board because they were there was singing and kind of laughing and everything. And it shows you how God can make even the worst condition, you know, okay. But then later he writes, about 12 years later, he writes to Joshua Speed. He says, you know what, Joshua, to be very honest, I'm really, I've been haunted ever since by those enslaved people who were in chains. So I really think that began a cycle of really becoming sympathetic.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think I'm talking a little too much here.
No, it's fascinating. I'm not kidding. We're talking to David S. Reynolds. The book is Abraham Lincoln in His Own Times. Every single page, the footnotes along, Mike Crowley, right? It's up to like 100 pages. But every single one of the 800, 900 pages of this book, I just kept reading going, okay, I thought I knew a lot about Lincoln. I clearly didn't. And every page leads one to think about bigger issues. It's fabulous. But let me get you out with this. It's 2020. And if we were so fortunate, Abraham Lincoln came back and he lands in Columbus, Ohio today, and he sees and he encounters this election occurring tomorrow, what would he think? What would Lincoln say about what's going on now? Would he say?
That's really interesting, because Lincoln lived in a time that was, hate to say it, but even more divided than our own time, because when he was elected, 11 states left America and formed another country. They thought it was another country. They had their own president, their own constitution, their own Congress, their own legislature, and everything. Lincoln never accepted it as another country, but still, the Confederate States of America. But in my book, he was aware of this tightrope walker named Blondin, Charles Blondin, who went back and forth over Niagara Falls without a net, of course. Many times he did it blindfolded. He did it on stilts. He did it backwards. He did it at night. He did it famously with 200-pound men on his shoulders, which is very difficult because who knows how the guy on top of you is going to be, and pushing a wheelbarrow. And Lincoln was often compared in popular cartoons to Blondin. And he himself several times said, "I'm Blondin." And when people used to approach him and say, why aren't you more radical about slavery, and why don't you make this a more anti-slavery war from the very beginning? He said, if Blondin were pushing his wheelbarrow across Niagara Falls, would you tell him to step left and step right? No, you would not. You would let him stay right in the middle, because he says, if I say the wrong thing, we're going to lose one of the border states. There were these five border states, Kentucky and Virginia. He said, we lose one of those, we're going to lose the war. And not only that, but he also didn't want to inflame, even before the Civil War, he didn't want to inflame an already volatile political situation. Okay. Right. The last thing that he would do if he were alive today, the last thing he would do, very last, is to pour gasoline on the flame of division. And you can interpret that however you want to, but that's the last thing he would do. Okay. He would always, he did that earlier in his career. It almost cost his life because he got in a duel. He went through what I call a Trump phase, where he used what back then was called slasher gaff rhetoric, where he really attacked a lot of people. And some guy, he didn't even know the guy. Lincoln got to choose the weapon because he was the challenged one. He criticized in kind of a Trump-like way, criticized his opponent. And Lincoln, as the challenged party, got to choose swords as being the dueling thing. Because the other guy was kind of small, and he was huge, and he had been a very good axe person, you know.
Right.
He said, "I'll split this guy from head to toe." Turns out he didn't even know the guy had been trained by an ex-Napoleonic War soldier in swordsmanship and had been a fencing instructor in Canada. You know, I know nothing about swords, but I do know that, you know, swordsmanship is more than just...
Yeah, if you're going to be in a duel, you want to do research on your opponent. You always want to do research.
Anyway, so...
So you think...
So he went through that phase, but then he really blossomed into this much more moderate centrist phase. Why? Because the nation was so divided, and he just didn't want to divided further. He knew that he could only worsen the situation with any kind of inflammatory rhetoric, which is why we have the two greatest speeches in history, the Gettysburg Address and the second inaugural address.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. All right. The book is Abraham Lincoln, His Own Times. And I'm with everybody else. Who would have thought that after 16,000 books on Abraham Lincoln, we needed another one, but we needed this one. It's fabulous. I really encourage people. The holidays are coming up. This is a great book to buy, guys. Hopefully from your local independent bookstore. Let me do this. A little bit of housekeeping. David Reynolds, stay with us. I have what we call our deserted island question for the end there. And the housekeeping is this, folks. Download us, follow us, write some reviews on Apple iTunes if you got a few minutes. Make sure tomorrow you wear your mask, wash your hands, and vote, because that's very important. We are off next week, but then we come back the following week with Chris Whipple, who has a wonderful book about the CIA chiefs. Really amazing collection of people and a great book. And here's the deserted island question. And David Reynolds, you may not know this, but we are relatively apolitical on this show. We try to stay away from it. But in honor of Tuesday and this week, if any one of us was going to write a book soon about this election, what would you call it? David Aldrich, you want to go first?
A Neo-Confederacy of Dunces.
Awesome. Awesome. Mike Crowley.
David did the same. I reappropriated. So One Nation Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was one that I had.
Very good. Excellent. David Reynolds, unfair. I did not give you the homework assignment. Do you have any ideas what you would call it? You would never write anything about anything as trivial as one particular election year, but if you did, if you really
know what you did. Oh, boy. That's, I guess, Haunted House of Cards or something.
Oh, excellent. You guys are so much funnier than I am. I was very serious. I think it's fear versus hope. And I really toyed with the order. I was going to just say fear. But that, and then I toyed with the order, but there is the fear on both sides. There's fear from people who don't like Trump that we're going to have another 4 years of it. There's fear on the Trump supporter side. Oh my God, those socialists are going to take over. So maybe it's just fear.
Good for you.
Yeah. But again, everybody, if you haven't voted, get out there and vote. David Reynolds, thank you so much. David,
thank you, Victoria. Thank you very much.
Zephyr. Mike Crowley, stay well, stay safe. Take care of a nice family.
David, great seeing you.
Claude Jennings, thanks for taking care of everything, my friend. We are out.